better world, one broadcast at a time.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners.
Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
Good afternoon, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, wherever you are tuned in. You are listening to Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. My name is Daniel Del Pielago, and as always, thank you so much to our listeners, to our supporters. You all mean so much to us, and thank you for tuning in every Tuesday here for Taking Action. I'm honored this afternoon to be joined by Iris Benson-Sulzer. She is with the D.C. Justice Lab. She is their policy and research associate, and I believe we're going to be joined shortly with another person associated with the Justice Lab, so we'll bring them into the conversation when they log on. But Iris, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. Would you like to introduce yourself and just, you know, share anything about yourself that you see fit?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on. As you said, my name is Iris Benson-Sulzer. I'm a policy and research associate for DC Justice Lab. So what that means is I contribute research and written materials in support of our mission and advocate for public safety policies that are evidence-based and community-rooted.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I wanted to first just to start off the conversation talking a little bit, if you would share with us a little about the work of the DC Justice Lab, any background on the organization would be great.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So we sort of have three prongs. We do research, policy advocacy, and training. And we're focused primarily on prosecution, policing, and punishment, specifically in DC. So we work to advocate for and lift up policies that are informed by DC residents and try to not only change some of the ways that these systems work in DC, but also change who gets a voice in deciding these policies and I'd start with that.
That's great. Thank you for the great work that you all do. I also want to introduce Damon Jones. He's a fellow of the organization. Damon, please introduce yourself and share with the audience anything about yourself.
Sorry, I'm trying to get my audio right.
You're good. We can hear you.
Okay, I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Oh, okay.
Wish I had some earpieces. Yeah, I'm Damon Jones, a proud graduate of the Policy Training Academy 2024. I was incarcerated for 28 years and was released in October of 2023. So I went into the National Reentry Network for Return to Citizens, into their Ready for Work program. And 2 weeks into the program, I was actually hired by the program to become a program coordinator. And so I was excited about that. So, you know, going right from that to the Policy Training Academy, you know, it was great because, you know, I was actually able to work with Return to Citizens while being a part of the job readiness program. And then taking the Policy Training Academy gave me more, you know, allowing me to become an advocate for Return to Citizens, which I have been doing ever since. I'm currently in a fellowship with Georgetown University's Pivot program, which is the entrepreneur program. We're taking the actual business courses and things of that nature with Georgetown professors. I'm due to graduate from there next month. Also, I'm currently interning with Prison Justice Initiative, which is a prison educational program. They have educational programs over in DC jail and Patuxent, Maryland, and a facility out there. So yeah, but I would like to, you know, say that, you know, one thing about the Policy Training Academy, it kind of was a catalyst, you know, for all the things that I'm doing now, and made all that stuff so much easier because they gave me so much education and insight about the ins and outs of DC policy and actually becoming an advocate. And, you know, me being out in the federal system for so long that I kind of, you know, was out of touch with what was going on in the city. So one thing that the Academy did was it put me back in touch, you know. So yeah, it's great.
Wow, that's wonderful. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. I was going to ask Iris if she could tell us a little bit more about the Academy, the goal, and why was it set up? And Damon, definitely want to come back to you and talk to a little more about your experience in the.
Sure, yeah. And Damon, I love that you said that it was a catalyst for what you're doing now, because that really is a big goal of, you know, what we're trying to do with the Policy Training Academy. And so what it is our Policy Training Academy is a week-long training. And the idea behind it is to help participants to eliminate barriers that prevent community members, especially Native Washingtonians, from participating in local policymaking. So it's a week-long in-person training where DC Justice Lab experts and also experts from other partner organizations train a cohort of about 10 to 12 community members on research, on campaign strategy, on how the lawmaking process happens in DC, on how to communicate effectively with the media and present an idea. So it's basically what we try to do is equip community organizations and community members with the same tools that we use so that they can be more effective advocates and change makers, excuse me. And so the idea is by the end of that week, they have a proposal of something that they've seen in their community that they think needs to be changed. And they present that at what we call our community safety fair. And some examples of past proposals, some have focused on more mentorship programs for youth or access to affordable housing, access to body cam footage or extended access. And so at the end of the week, the community safety fair is an opportunity for anyone in the public to come by and see these proposals, talk to the advocates, learn about the things that their ideas. And we've been really grateful to have lawmakers there, to have media there in the past. This will be the third time we're doing this. So yeah, it's definitely one of my favorite programs that we do here at DC Justice Lab.
Yeah, that sounds very cool, and love to hear a little bit more about that. Damon, as somebody who has gone through the fellowship, can you talk to us a little bit more about what your experience was, what you learned, you know, especially working with other fellows? And as you mentioned, you know, it set you up to want to do more of this work, this advocacy work. But can you share with us a little bit more about your experience in the fellowship?
Yeah, like I said, it was just a catalyst for me. I mean, just the experience of learning, you know, from actual lawyers and people who've been to law school about, you know, how it works, and then hearing it in a way that, you know, relates to me, you know, as far as being a returning citizen, because, you know, a lot of the advocacy work that's being done is for returning citizens, you know, also, you know, for homelessness and things of that nature. But, you know, I only can speak for myself, you know, being a returning citizen, like being out of touch for so long. Like I said, it was just so ideal being able to learn in that short amount of time and having things put to me so simply that, you know, stuff that they probably been learning for years. So, and then actually being able to present, you know, see my ideas come to fruition, you know, at the community fair, you know, that was even, you know, more. So yeah, like, I mean, it's kind of, you know, I guess it's kind of hard to put in words, but like me being in the position that I was in, that, you know, it was instrumental in me taking my next step, you know, just being a productive citizen in society, because our communities are so much in need of, you know, strong men and women. But, you know, so it was important for me to be able to take that next step. And the Policy Training Academy definitely played a big role in that.
That's right. No, thank you for that. And I think, you know, as I was looking at the Justice Lab's website, you know, one thing that struck out to me, which I think I knew, but it's always important, I think, to remember this and to always refresh our minds about this, is that oftentimes people, you know, resort to committing crimes, activities that could potentially land them in the justice system because of need, right? Because there is need in the community. And, you know, there were some stark numbers and data on your website that talks about, you know, how disproportionately policing is, for example, in Black neighborhoods, how lack of resources are, you know, disproportionate between Black and white neighborhoods. I don't know, Iris, could you talk a little bit about that? What happens or what is not happening for folks that put them in these unfortunate situations sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that's not really talked about enough, is that public safety is about a lot more than law enforcement and about courts and about punishment. We kind of address crime by reacting to it after it happens, oftentimes, rather than thinking about how to give people what they need so they don't need to resort to that in the first place. You know, if you look at, a while ago I was looking at a breakdown of the people who are in the DC jail, and half of them were unemployed at the time that they were arrested. And if you look at the communities in DC that are the most heavily policed, those are also the communities that are more likely to be living in a food desert, and who are more likely to be struggling with unemployment, poverty. And then if people do enter the system and they come back out of the system, a lot of the support that is really needed for returning citizens is very much lacking. And there's of course barriers to employment, barriers to housing, and all of those things just kind of can make it into a revolving door where people enter the system because they don't have what they need to stay out of it. And then once they're released, there are even more barriers to having what they need to, just not become involved in the system in the first place. And that's one thing that I noticed back when we had our first Policy Training Academy and Community Safety Fair in 2023 was that a lot of the proposals were really focused on things that would prevent system involvement in the first place, like expanding SNAP benefits or universal right to housing and better services for people who are homeless. And so I really think that public safety policy needs to be focused a lot more on the things that people need so that they don't end up involved in the system. And the system just eats so many resources that could be spent on actually giving people what they need in the first place.
No, that's right. And, coincidentally, as I was doing a little research for this show on one of the email lists that I'm on, I received an email about Republican members of the House voted on April 10 to adopt a Senate-passed budget resolution that would provide over $5 trillion to extend tax cuts, increasing funding for immigration enforcement, and fund other Trump administration priorities while cutting at least $1.5 trillion in federal budget through cuts to other federal programs, including Medicaid and SNAP, as you just mentioned, right? So unfortunately, what we continue to see is this disinvestment up front in what could keep folks housed and what could keep folks fed and keep them away from having to resort to other activities that could land them in the criminal system. Damon, I don't know, how do you react to that? As you know, through your lived experience, is that something that you agree with and other folks in your community? What's the sentiment there?
Well, you kind of lost me soon. You said Republican back,
yes, sir.
Anything positive. But yeah, one of the things I was thinking about, and I'm sorry, man, because you said, so much good stuff that I can relate to, that I stopped doing when you were talking about the disproportionate with the policing and underserved neighborhoods compared to, your Georgetown neighborhoods and, so forth. So just how the policing is being done. So if you go to a fluid neighborhood of Georgetown community, whatever, yeah, it's a lot of police presence, and it's
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, with an important announcement regarding a national town hall meeting. Report card on Trump, the first 100 days, strategies for resistance and transformation. Friday, April 25th, 7:00 p.m. sharp, at the historic Shiloh Baptist Church, 1500 9th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Doors will open at 6:30 p.m. sharp. Speakers include noted political economist Dr. Julianne Malvo, the NAACP's Hillary Shelton, National Urban League's Tara Murray, Diedrich Muhammad from the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and Mel Foote from the Constituency for Africa. There will also be an open mic for you and the audience to share your assessment of Trump and the way forward. For further information, IBW21.org. That's IBW21.org.
Daycare center in the neighborhood, and he was actually just going to get some batteries for him. So he had a black bag in his hand when he was getting out of the car, and the, undercover officers pop, see him with a black bag and a hoodie on, and they ran and tackled him. And their excuse is that they gave him a warning, and come to find out that he had a hearing disability. That's why he didn't hear the warning, and he kept walking, and they ran, tackled him. He spent a week in jail. So the point I'm making is that had these officers took the time to visit these neighborhood daycare centers, you know, all the stakeholders in the neighborhood, these officers need to be familiar with the same way I'm sure they are in these Georgetown neighborhoods. So that's what I wanted to speak on as far as the police are concerned. We got plenty of police in the neighborhood. It's just how they're policing. Like, this incident would have never happened had they known, you know, of this neighborhood daycare center. Had they known, made themselves familiar, they probably would have known that this young kid had a hearing disability. And that whole incident that made it on video that went viral, of the police tackling, choking, and cuffing this individual, and him spending a week in jail, probably would have been avoided. So, you know, I just wanted to use that as an example as, you know, of the policing situation.
That's right. And a number that stood out to me on the website was, you know, DC spends over $500 million annually on policing. Iris, you know, the city right now is in its budget process and it's having some current issues related, you know, to the federal government and being able to use its current budget. But regardless, it appears that a lot of cuts are coming. You know, how do you think that impacts folks in the criminal justice system and folks, you know, returning? What impact will that have, these, you know, unfortunate, I don't want to call them budget cuts right now because we haven't seen it, but, you know, this kind of dire outlook for the city's budget and its ability to provide safety net resources for the community?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, we're kind of in, whole city is kind of in limbo of not knowing whether or not it's going to happen. I'm sorry, your question was around what would happen to the safety net resources?
Or... Well, I mean, I think just the effect that it'll have on some of the work that you all do around, you know, the criminal justice system. Do we expect to see, as the city scrambles to find money and it always prioritizes policing in its budgets, you know, what could potentially be the result of that? Or is that something you all are looking at?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that I've looked into extensively, like the impact of these cuts or what specifically the DC government is going to cut. But I mean, we've heard, you know, the news has been pointing to, and I think public statements have pointed to, them having to cut sort of all aspects of things, from public education to policing. But like you said, that usually tends to get prioritized. And, you know, there's just a whole host of public services that seem like they could be under threat from this, relating to housing, relating to food. And I think it's important to think about which of these taxpayer-funded, word is escaping me, programs or agencies are actually effective. And it kind of brings me back to something Damon was saying, that so much of policing in DC is just not only harmful and traumatizing, and the example that he just described was awful, but unfortunately not incredibly surprising when you look at how MPD approaches policing, especially in majority Black neighborhoods in DC. There was a report that came out a while ago from ACLU DC that said in these stop and frisk or jump outs that police do, you know, it's, they actually recovered a gun, which is their stated purpose, around 1% of the time. So 99% of that is just a wasted effort and traumatizing an innocent person. And, you know, we're spending all this money on jumping out at people and, you know, really just not only harming our communities and harming just trust between the police and communities as well, that it just seems like an incredible, like there's so much room to cut that down and cut down the wastefulness that money is going towards.
No, that's right. Thank you for that.
Same use of manpower you use to jump out on the people. If you ingratiate yourself into the community probably will give you the information that you're looking for. The gun is behind the trash can. You know what I'm saying? Like, you spend so much time making it a us against y'all and you know, like, so everybody in the community, when the police come, had their guards up. You know, whether you called them to protect you, you still got your guards up because you know, that's just the narrative, bro. So it's like, instead of spending all that money jumping out, like, if you just ingratiate yourself in the community, the upstanding members of the community are going to let you know where the gun at. You know what I'm saying? How about try that approach? Boy, sir, I'm sorry.
And that then undermines public safety because people, community members aren't going to want to come forward with information or talk to police if they, are afraid and distrustful.
No, thank you. Thank you for that. I think that's really important. And I think, you know, what we've been hearing, at least from this new presidential administration, is, you know, how bad DC is and how it needs to be cleaned up. And we're seeing, a desire to increase policing, a desire to, get rid of encampments and kind of just blaming victims for the reality of, being unhoused, being very low income, no income. So I think, Damon, as a returning citizen, how does that make you feel, especially coming back to your city, somebody messaging how bad it is?
To a certain extent, I get it because, all the studying, a lot of work I've done with DC Justice Lab to get better understanding. I get it. They need that to be the narrative, bro. They need that to be the narrative to push mm-hmm. their policies. You know what I'm saying? Like, I've had meetings with Iris, if this, you qualified as this, academians who do data research and analysts on underprivileged neighborhoods in my city. And they never even been there. So I know why it happens the way it happens. Like, if you're trying to push this agenda, if you're trying to get this funding, you want to paint the picture you want to paint. So yeah, it's bad that, these people is not even taking the time to really find out what's going on in these communities, but benefiting from policy and agendas they trying to push. So yeah, they're gonna paint whatever narrative they want to paint. I don't even watch the news no more, bro, because picture that is being painted, I see is agenda based. You understand what I'm saying? So as long as it's agenda based, I feel terrible about it. Is to answer your question?
No. Thank you for that, and I think you hit the nail on the head there. That they create these narratives to push forth their agenda, right? They create these narratives. They don't invest in what really needs to be invested in to get their desired outcomes. Fortunately, there are organizations like the Justice Lab, good folks like you, Damon, who are doing the work to counter those narratives. Iris, I know you guys do quite a lot, and you had mentioned some of the things you all are working on. What else do you all have coming up that you'd like to share?
Yeah, so what we're most excited about right now is the Community Safety Fair. So that's an opportunity for residents of the district who participated in our Policy Training Academy to come together and present their ideas. It's kind of like a science fair format where it's open to the public and people can just walk around and talk to the advocates about their ideas, about their proposals, and really learn from residents who are closest to these issues on their ideas for what will improve public safety and what will make us all safer and freer. And so that's coming up on Saturday, April 26th. It's on the fifth floor of MLK Library from 1 to 4. Open to the public. I hope everyone stops by and just checks out these ideas. It's been really wonderful in the past to see how the community comes together and It also is an opportunity for people to talk directly with, you know, kind of across community, as Damon was saying, they're, you know, just talking a little bit about sort of a divide and like narrative between people who are directly affected by the system and people who are maybe, you know, working in policy or academia. And this is an event where we really see those groups of people and other groups of people, students, lawmakers, just come together and ask each other questions. And yeah, so anyone wants to find out more about that, if you, all of our social media handles are DC Justice Lab, or also at DCJusticeLab.org. And yeah, it's at MLK Library from 1 to 4 p.m. on Saturday, April 26th. So hopefully see a lot of people there.
Wonderful, wonderful. And Damon, I want to ask you about what your project was in the last fair you participated in. But first, let me remind folks, you are tuned into Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. My name is Daniel Del Piélago. This afternoon, I am joined by Iris Benson-Sulzer. She is a Policy and Research Associate with the D.C. Justice Lab, and Damon Jones, who has been through the fellowship that we've been discussing here in the fair it leads up to. If you have any questions, if you want to share any insight into the conversation we've been having, please feel free to give us a call. 202-588-0893 is the number to call. 202-588-0893. Damon, do you mind sharing what your project was and you know how that was received and what was the inspiration for it?
Yeah, crazy. It was last year, so I was sitting here trying to make sure I remember, because I don't work so many projects. Like I said, the Academy propelled me into so much different work. I don't work on so many projects since then. But what I presented for the safety fair, let me say first, I had started out wanting to present, because I'm like a totally against, and I'm trying to get people on board against the word safety when it comes to DC and our communities. Because I think, you know, when people think of safety, they think of police, you know, and they think of locking people up, you know, more jails, more that make things safe. So, you know, I kind of, you know, I've been pushing to switch the narrative to public health, you know, It seems that what the focus need to be more on than public safety. You know, it needs to be more focused on public health. We need more healthcare providers, more mental health services inside of these communities than police. So like, you know, every time I hit safety, even with, you know, what we're talking about today is, you know, one of the things is safety summit, you know what I'm saying? What's it called? A safety, I don't want to say the wrong name. But yeah, so that's one of the things. But what I actually ended up doing for the fair was I came up with a mentorship program that was surrounded about putting mentors into these justice impact neighborhoods, like on a 24-hour basis. So what I wanted to do, what I put together was, you know, actually trying to find housing, getting with the housing authority. And actually, when I put this proposal together, I actually had in there where I wanted to provide housing for the mentors, where though they would be on site 24 hours a day. Because I can remember growing up around Simple City, Condor Terrace area of Southeast as a kid. And, you know, we had a community center, and a community center was great, man. We had boxing, the pool. It was a pool actually in the community center. And we could access it, you know, it was indoor. We could access it almost all year round sometimes. So community center was great, but guess what? All the directors and everything, they went home at 6 o'clock. The community center, you know, outside of it, you know, became a drug hub from that time until the next morning when it opened back up. So, you know, that was the problem, because, you know, us being kids of that environment, usually our parents were, you know, usually just underage mothers, you know, they were outside. So we were outside. So, you know, we were out in this environment, and the only time we had the services at the community center was during the daytime. So that was the problem. So I, you know, I always thought about that. Like, man, I wish I had the type of guy that was working with me with the boxing and, you know, my football and all of that, you know, even during the off hours, you know, I needed that, you know. So, like, yeah, so that's what I presented. I presented a program that would solve that problem that was, you know, your job, you know, would be in that, in what I try to create, or what I'm trying to create, you know, would be almost essentially a service to your community the same way. And I formatted like the same way you sign up to do 4 years with the armed forces for this country. You know what I'm saying? Sign up to do 4 years for your community. So that means, you know, you're in the army, you know, whenever somebody attack you, you gotta be ready. So the same way, whenever these kids need you, cause I can remember a time waking up 2 or 2, 3 o'clock in the morning and my mother is not there. You know, I may have been woken by gunshots, you know what I'm saying? So I'm scared. And I have nowhere to turn. I have nobody to call, you know. So I don't have a 911 emergency per se, so I can't call the police. So yeah, it would have been good to have somebody I could reach out to even at that time as a youth growing up in the neighborhood. So yeah, that's the long version of, but yeah, that's what I created. And I kind of got into a roadblock with the housing, the DC Housing Authority. But I'm still fighting, man. You know, that's the thing about being an advocate, man, and the thing about having people like DC Justice Lab, which, you know, having your back, that, you know, it's an ongoing fight, and I'm going to continue with it. So, yeah, that's what I presented.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing that, Damon. And that actually, you know, I do a lot of work around public housing issues. And I think that's a great idea. You know, one thing to note is how many vacancies exist, how many vacant units exist currently in public housing over there. You know, at Benning Terrace, aka Simple City, alone, you know, there are a lot of vacant units that could be used either for programming as
right,
like you've laid out, or to provide housing to people who can, you know, support the community. And it's interesting that you bring this up as well, because the Housing Authority is updating its what they call their ACOP plan, their Admissions and Continued Occupancy Plan. And one of the regulations in that document, that's the guiding document for public housing residents, is a mandatory community service for you know, people who qualify, right, who are not senior citizens. And there's a couple of other exceptions. But public housing residents who aren't currently employed or senior citizens are expected to do 96 hours of community service. And I think if they had, you know, opportunities or you know, opportunities like the ones you're laying out, I think that could go a long way in helping to, you know, have people in the community work to improve and maintain their communities. So I think some wonderful ideas there that I know I'm gonna hit you up after this, Damon. We could talk a little more about that, but thank you so much for sharing that, because I think that's what it needs, right? The solutions are known by the people who have been through it, who know what it's going to take to make the conditions better,
right,
and improve people's lives, so we can move, you know, turn the corner, as it were, around some of these issues that continue to ail the city. Iris, I noticed, you know, I think along. Please, no, please go right ahead.
I'm sorry, I just don't want to miss this, because it just seems like that since I've been home, like, you know, I'm like a new baby, because I haven't been out here in almost 30 years. My city is like totally new to me. But one thing I noticed, right, and doing all the reading that I've done while I was incarcerated, like, you know, the old ways of doing things, the Black Panther Party, things of that nature, is that we're kind of scared to tackle what's tough now. You know what I'm saying? Like, we can do what's easy, and, you know, like a lot of these refugee services, you know, they give you a gift card and a, you know, a referral to go get your ID and your SNAP card. But, you know, when it comes down to doing the things that are tough, you know what I'm saying, that's what it seemed like we done got away from. You know, you look at inspirational organizations like the Black Panther Party back in the 70s and the 80s, you know, you know, we know what happened with destroyed them, but you know, while they were doing the good work, it was like they were tackling things that were tough, man. The police was terrorizing their neighborhood, man, and they found a way that they could carry arms and protect their neighborhoods, man. And that, you know, of course, you saw the results of that, but you know, they were all about tackling what, you know, getting and tackling what was tough, man. And it just seemed like we done moved away from the tough issues. And so, you know, we do what's easy and just keep it moving, man. But I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just had to.
No, I agree. And that actually, you know, that was part of the follow-up question that I wanted to kick over to Iris, because I think, we, as an organizer, you know, I think I believe in the, I think the generally accepted philosophy is that, you know, those who feel it know it, right? And they know the solutions. But unfortunately, in this country, oftentimes, you know, it takes a whole lot more than that to get people to listen and to get some traction. And I know, Iris, you all offer some resources on how to change the law, you know, and could you just talk a little bit about that and how you couple it, you know, with the input and direction of folks like Damon who have the lived experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, part of our vision as an organization is, you know, not just to transform DC's approach to public safety, but also transform how lawmaking happens. And something that we try to do with every policy that we advocate for is make sure that we're working closely with the people who are impacted by that policy. And we actually work very closely with the National Reentry Network for Returning Citizens on a number of things. And that partnership has been incredibly valuable for DC Justice Lab. And, you know, it really takes a whole sort of community of organizations and of advocates to just sort of transform the voices that are being heard. And in terms of how to sort of educating the public on the actual, you know, logistics of how a idea becomes a proposal, a bill, and then becomes a law. That's one thing we also try to do with our online library. The idea is for it to be a tool for advocates and community members, not just to learn, but also to be able to take that information and then talk to decision makers and advocate for the changes that they see see a need for in their communities. And so it's really, I think there's no way to have meaningful change without that change being shaped by the people who are most impacted by the problem.
That's right. No, thank you for that. And you know, I think it's important you know, to talk a little bit about how, you know, at least at the current moment, given that there's so much changing on the federal level, but, you know, how is DC reacting to, you know, the work that you all are doing and the suggestions? Like, is there a receptive ear on the city council? You know, I may know what the mayor's up to, but in general, you know, do we feel like there's at least some ground to work on with some of these initiatives?
Want me to go first, Iris? Because my answer is short. It's just so funny that you know, I haven't been home that long, so I really only participated in one election. But during that process, for DC City Council, you know, the work that I'm in and the space that I'm in, you know, I was getting contacted by so many different candidates. At the time, I was living in Ward 7. So I was getting contacted by so many different candidates, you know, who wanted to meet with, you know, me and my network of returned citizens, you know, just doing good work. And it's just so funny, like, you know, all the 28 years I was in prison, and, you know, DC Justice Lab and National Reentry Network of Returned Citizens, as well as many other organizations, fought hard for us to get voting rights, you know, while we were in prison. And so, it's so funny and ironic that, you know, we were so disconnected from the process, you know, being in the federal system that, you know, and then looking at it now, since I've been home, and the way that these officials are trying to connect with us, you know, to push their agenda forward, to get us behind them, you know, say we're doing this and that for the attorney system. And that's not to say that some of them are not genuine. I just haven't, as of yet, called all of them, my favors in, you hear me? Because, that's, you know, right. I definitely advocated for Councilmember Felder, and then, you know, the Ward 8 seat is currently open. And if I can do a shout out, I'm currently endorsing Sharnell Cheney for that seat. It was, so yeah, you know, it's just kind of ironic how when we were all the way out Beaumont, Texas, and Florence, Colorado, and them federal penitentiary, that we didn't hear for any of these elected officials. But since I've been home, it's like my phone is always ringing from their office asking, can I come and, you know, support and, you know, get a return of citizen voice, you know, and this and that, right? So yeah, that's just what I wanted to add.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing that. I think that's important to note. You know, it is all politics when it comes down to the end, to the bottom of it.
Right.
But I think, you know, if we use that strategically, we can hopefully make some change. And Iris, you know, I don't know if you have any follow-up to that, you know, on how to build relationships that, you know, that lead to clear, at least, you know, through the city council policy wins for folks in these situations.
Yeah, I mean, I also, Damon, I love that you mentioned Sharnell, because she actually was also in the Policy Training Academy.
Absolutely. Running for Ward 8 City Council. Yeah.
But to respond to your question or your comment about just the current environment, I mean, I think, you know, DC is in a unique position because we're not a state, and that puts our lawmakers in a unique position, as you can see with the whole budget thing going on right now. But I think that there's sort of, even when there's kind of a backtracking on some of the progress that might have been made a few years ago in terms of rethinking these systems, I do think that there's still opportunities for collaboration, opportunities for change, even, you know, in times that might be a little bit tougher in regards to the narrative that's being pushed, especially on a national level. And yeah, so I think that's, I guess what I'm trying to say there is that there are a lot of things that people have brought up through the Policy Training Academy and that affect public safety, but that aren't, you know, sorry, the word's escaping me here. I guess what my main point is that there are some things that most people can agree on regardless, such as, you know, the need for more mentorship and recreation for youth, like Damon was mentioning. And there are different things that can still be done even when we're in a difficult environment.
That's right. No, and I think that, you know, the realization that the system is a system, and we have to learn to, you know, play it to get what we need. But really, you know, the change is going to come from the grassroots and from leaders such as Damon, who are, you know, leading the way and suggesting, you know, the changes that need to happen. You know, we're getting close to wrapping up. So once again, I want to thank both of you for being on this afternoon and talking about this very important and timely topic in our city. Do you want to remind folks about any work that you all are doing, Iris?
Sure. Yeah, I'll just remind folks once again to stop by our community safety fair on Saturday, April 26th at MLK Library. Open to the public, no registration or anything's required. And yeah, it's a great opportunity to hear some just really great ideas from people who have who spend this time with us working really hard to craft these proposals. And you can also view past ones on our website. You go to dcjusticelab.org. You can see Damon's proposal and all of the other ones from past cohorts. So yeah, hope to see everyone there.
Very cool. Very cool. Damon, as we begin to wrap up, you know, what words do you have, you know, not only for your community, because I think that's important to use this platform and we try to create this platform, but for the broader community around these issues, anything you want to leave us with?
Well, if I can, first of all, I'd like to thank you, Daniel, for having me on and allowing me to voice what needs to be heard on your platform. But if I can, I would like to send prayers out to who we mentioned, Shawnell Taney. He was recently submitted to Washington Hospital Center. She had a brain aneurysm.
Oh, wow.
And she's actually in ICU right now. I'm probably on my way to see her. She's doing a little better. But like I say, it was just so important because she's been working so hard with all the work she does in the community. And she's actually trying to run this campaign. And she kind of worked herself into the situation that she's in. So like, that's like the most important thing on my mind right now. So I would like, you know, if everybody could send prayers out to Shawnell Taney. Is currently suffering from a brain aneurysm, but she's doing better. So thank you for that.
Well, no problem. And for yourself, you know, what do you hope to keep moving forward for this year at least?
Oh, well, you know, just you know, everything that we talked about and just fighting, you know, staying in the fight, man. Going to an event tonight that Free Minds, which is a reentry advocacy organization, is putting on. So just, you know, just trying to stay learning. And that's one of the things I got from the Policy Academy is like, you know, I'm still a baby, man. So, you know, even when you're talking about hooking up later, you know, I know it's so much more in this fight that I can get from you, you know, because it's just about learning different ways to fight, man, and keep fighting, you know what I'm saying? So, yeah, I'm excited about getting some fresh ideas from you, you know, about how to punch them in the face in a different way. You know what I'm saying? So that's what it's all about, man. And just keep punching, man. You know, so yeah, that's it.
That's right. Well, thank you both so much. You know, we like to use this platform to bring what sometimes appear to be different issues, right? Like, oh, that's criminal justice reform and this is housing and that's environmental, with a realization that they all intersect and we could, you know, we are all better served figuring out ways to push our own work and demands forward, but figuring out how to do that together, I think is crucial, especially in these trying times. So I want to commend you, both of you, for the work you are doing. And thank you so much for taking the time this afternoon to share it with the WPFW audience. We want to, you know, we'll leave an open invite to come back and to talk with us in the future. But thank you both so much for joining us this afternoon and wishing you all the best. Folks, stay tuned. You've got Capitalism, Race, and Democracy after this. And then you've got the news in just a couple of minutes. So thank you all for tuning in, and we'll catch you next Tuesday. Thank you, Iris and Damon.
Thank you so much.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Harvard University is standing its ground against the Trump administration, apparently becoming the first elite school refusing to comply with the administration's demands. In a letter that was sent to Harvard's president, Dr. Alan Garber, on Friday, the Ivy League school was told to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, programs, stop support of certain student activist groups, ban the wearing of masks, enact merit-based hiring and admissions reform, and more. However, Dr. Garber stated in a letter of his own, and I quote, "No government should dictate what private universities can teach, whom they can admit and hire, and areas of study and inquiry that they can pursue," end quote. As a result of the school's refusal to comply with the demands, the Trump administration has frozen over $2 billion in multi-year grants and contracts at the university. Trump has also threatened to tax Harvard as a political entity. Former President Joe Biden is returning to the national stage tonight to discuss Social Security, as concern rises over the Trump administration's agenda being a threat to it. The White House has vowed that it would not cut Social Security benefits, saying that any changes are intended to reduce waste and fraud. Meanwhile, Elon Musk, one of Trump's most influential advisors, has called Social Security, quote, "the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time." Former President Biden's speech tonight will take place in Chicago at the National Conference of Advocates, Counselors, and Representatives for the Disabled, or ACRD. Rachel Buck, the executive director of the ACRD, said, and I quote, "As bipartisan leaders have long agreed, Americans who retire after paying into Social Security their whole lives deserve the vital support and caring services they receive. We are thrilled that President Biden will be joining us to discuss how we can work together for a stable and successful future for Social Security," end quote. Today, April 15th, 2025, marks 78 years since Jackie Robinson broke Major League Baseball's color barrier. That day, he made his debut for the Brooklyn Dodgers, becoming the first black player in the major leagues since the year 1884. Jackie Robinson described how it felt to make that historic accomplishment.
"I felt that it was finally the elimination of one of the bigger challenges that most Americans had to face. I felt real good as an American, much more so than as being the first Negro in organized baseball."
Since the year 2004, MLB formally established April 15th as Jackie Robinson Day. On each Jackie Robinson Day, all MLB players and coaching staff continue the tradition of wearing his number 42 during the day's games. Tributes are also being sponsored by several organizations, including the Jackie Robinson Museum in New York, where Mr. Robinson's widow, Rachel Robinson, who is 102 years old, is expected to attend. In the D.C. area, the city's Department of Health says a person with a confirmed measles diagnosis ate at a local restaurant earlier this month. Anyone who was at the Five Guys restaurant at 1400 I Street Northwest on Saturday, April 5th, between 3:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. may have been exposed to the measles virus. Symptoms of measles develop in two stages. The first stage begins 7 to 14 days after exposure and often presents a fever over 101 degrees, along with a runny nose, red, watery eyes, and a cough. The second stage occurs 3 to 5 days after the initial symptoms start and consists of a rash on the face that gradually spreads to the rest of the body. DC Health says a person with measles is contagious from 4